Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Sustainability is a much bigger thing than just being able to raise food without putting petroleum-based chemicals on it. It's being able to teach somebody else how to do it.
That's Greg Marlette of Hardway Farms. His is one of the many voices we'll hear in the first half of today's program as we discuss what it means to grow food sustainably. Then, Stephanie Hartono takes a look at the carbon footprint of her morning cuppa. We have vegetarians in mind for our two recipes. Chef Daniel Orr prepares a cold soup with fresh broccoli and a simple salad of roasted tomatoes and snow peas. And finally, we sit down with a researcher from Indiana University to talk about how schools can impact the rates of childhood obesity in the U.S. Stay with us. Welcome back to Mia Partlow, who was gone last week at the Public Radio News Directors Incorporated conference in Houston, Texas. We in the biz like to call that Prindy. Welcome back, Mia. So I'm afraid to ask, how was the weather?
You know, it was actually cooler in Houston than it was in Indiana, but it was so much more humid.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. So what do you got for us today?
Well, that's the thing. The weather was the news this week. Severe temperatures and very little rainfall are threatening what had been expected to be the nation's largest corn crop in generations. Parts of Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky are experiencing severe or extreme drought conditions paired with temperatures above 100 degrees. What's even more worrisome for farmers is these next few weeks are crucial for pollinating corn crops, and cooler and wetter conditions are required for successful pollination. Does the weather forecast call for relief anytime soon? According to Eric Albach, a farmer in central Indiana, quote, "All we can do is hope and wait," unquote. The California ban on foie gras went into effect on the first of this month, but chefs and restaurateurs aren't taking the ban lying down. A group of businesses filed a lawsuit claiming the law is vague and puts the onus on restaurants to find out what they can and cannot serve. It's not clear, though, if the law will be strictly enforced, so some chefs are throwing caution to the wind and serving it anyway. If caught, they could be forced to pay a $1,000 fine. And the Farm Bill is back on our radar as the House introduced its 557-page draft on Thursday. While the Senate's version trimmed nearly $24 billion from the deficit, the House's version proposes $35 billion in cuts. The markup period for the bill is slated to begin on July 11th. Follow the latest in foodie news and notes throughout the week on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats.
Mia Partlow, thanks for being here.
You bet.
One of the big buzzwords in agriculture today is sustainability. It's all about making sure natural resources are not depleted or permanently damaged so that we can farm into the future. But how best to do this, and who's really making the commitment for the long term? In part three of Harvest Public Media series on The Farmer of the Future, Jessica Najunas reports that as more farmers from varied agriculture techniques embrace the idea of sustainability, their open-ended definitions will help shape the next generation of farming.
The farmer of the future will grow food and raise animals with tomorrow in mind. If the soil, air, and water they use to produce food is damaged, good luck feeding anyone. Unlike the organic label, sustainable tends to have a floating definition. You can't be certified sustainable, so many people have come up with their own idea of the word.
It's a sort of long definition, so bear with me.
Rob Hedberg is the National Director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Sustainability Program. He gives the official USDA definition.
The term sustainable agriculture means an integrated system of plant and animal production practices having a site-specific application.
It's not organic and it's not industrial. It's a mix of all the good practices from each. And it's a tricky movement to pin down, too, because most farmers can say, I'm sustainable.
What is sustainability?
What is sustainability?
What is sustainability?
What is sustainability?
That was Jim Tess, Brett Wallings, Guy Schlapper, and Amy Pickering. Opening day at the midweek Columbia, Missouri Farmers Market has brought six farms with booths displaying mostly produce.
Everybody talks about being green, but in my mind, farming, it's being brown. Brown's really the new green.
This idea of sustainability, what does it mean to you?
Sustainability to me, especially being an heirloom farmer, means that we can reclaim the seeds out of these plants and reproduce the same product in the end.
If you start losing your brown, you ain't gonna grow anything. So soil is important. Inputs are important. By the same token, you just got to get back.
You spend more time in the field doing it by hand rather than by machine when you're doing it our way. So, but in the end, we have a better product for sure.
Do you make a lot of money?
No, not at this. No.
Sustainability to be able to financially sustain your business by making the money that you invest back into your business.
Sustainability to me is using the land in a way that you can continue to use it productively for the next generation.
5 hours northwest of this small farmer's market of opinions in Ceresco, Nebraska, you'll find young farmer William Powers.
My wife and I have a small farm here in the saline wetlands of Saunders County called Darby Springs Farm.
They live in a small home that's more modest than the others along the rural road that is just feet from his front door. Outside, he has a movable fence that keeps two horses and a cow from wandering off. Next door, a makeshift chicken coop houses about a dozen heritage breed birds.
I don't know if there will ever be a point where we can say we are a sustainable farm. Sustainability goes beyond something that's written down. And so sustainability is a journey.
There's a farmer in northeast Kansas that is on that sustainable journey right now.
Dan Howell, a local farmer rancher in Marshall County, Kansas.
Most of his over 1,500 acres once yielded strictly row crops, milo, soybeans, wheat, the classics in Kansas. But at the age of 60, Howell has changed.
How can I live in that model and make it work better for me? And so this is a lot of the things why I'm changing some of my deals, because I don't like buying $3 and $4 fuel. And so these are things that I can do to buy less of it and still be productive.
Howell no longer relies on combines. Instead, he uses high tunnels to plant in the cool months, a young fruit orchard to grow produce, and a shiitake mushroom grove built into an old cluster of trees.
In society today, we don't have a real strong sense of accepting diversity in agriculture and different things. I've had several friends that, you know, are good people and they've just got a different look at things, but, you know, they got, why don't you let me rent that ground and plant, grow corn and the soybeans instead of running cows on that ground? And, you know, my comment is, well, you know, if I wanted to grow corn and soybeans, I could do that myself, but that's not my interest. But they thought, you know, the model that I was wanting to work with, like I'd fallen off a rock fence or something.
As a reformed row crop farmer, Dan Howell describes his own life. He made much more money than he does now. He looked to the future and knew, after decades of planting soybeans, that it could not sustain him or his family for very long. Jessica Najunas, Harvest Public Media.
Hear more stories from the team of reporters at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org.
Sustainability is a much bigger thing than just being able to raise food without putting petroleum-based chemicals on it. It's being able to teach somebody else how to do it.
That's Greg Marlette, owner and operator of Hardway Farms, tossing in his two cents about what it means to be sustainable. For him, keeping Hoosier cuisine locally raised is a top priority. He gives Betsy Shepherd of Traditional Arts Indiana a tour of his backyard pig farm in Martinsville, Indiana.
When Greg invited me to his home to talk about local pig farming, he warned me that Hardway Farms is far from your conventional ag operation. Greg's farm, which he describes as postage stamp size, rests in a plot no bigger than most backyards. According to Greg, it's not how much land you own, but what you do with it that counts.
These are our pigs. They do a really great job. They grow quick. They grow well. I would not want to pick her up by her back leg now.
The governing principle of Hardway Farms is efficiency, not the kind practiced in factory-style farming, but an efficiency that comes from using all of one's resources. Greg uses animal and plant compost to fertilize the ground, on which he grows a variety of seasonal crops, including grass to feed the pigs and wheat for natural crop coverage. He also uses the compost to make hot boxes to grow plants in the winter and collects rainwater and snow for irrigation. But Greg will be the first to tell you, the learning curve is slow. In fact, his farm is named for the painful process of trial by error.
Everything we did was the hard way. We did not know what we were doing. There was a lot of trial and error, and we've definitely learned some things.
Even after effectively harvesting the meat, Greg's battles weren't over.
I had meat coming out my ears, and nobody wanted to buy it. Good, homegrown, no antibiotics, no steroids, just pure good pork, and I could not sell it, undercutting Walmart. About that time, Morgan County, several people got together and decided to start a farmer's market. And we signed on. And we were at the farmer's market the very first day that they opened. It took off. We started selling a few cuts here and there. We broke even, so we were pretty happy.
Greg's produce and pork can only be purchased at the Martinsville and Morrisville farmer's markets. Here's why.
I want to deal directly with my customers so that they can ask questions if they have them. And so I can know who's getting my pigs. You know, I still have a connection to it, even once it's in the wrapper.
Greg says there's an economic incentive to local farming.
And even though I literally have a postage stamp farm, we've been able to be part of economic community development. We don't even try to compare our product or our prices to Walmart anymore. If Walmart slapped an organic label on some of their very best cuts, we would still far surpass what Walmart has available. It's just because the animal was handled humanely, it was talked to, loved on, and it makes for a better product. So they're definitely interesting critters. They've got minds of their own and attitudes of their own, and he doesn't want to be petted. She gets jealous. She's like, hey, if you want to pet somebody, pet me.
Hear more from Betsy Shepherd and the entire team at Traditional Arts Indiana on their second serving series on their website, traditionalartsindiana.org. Now something for the veggie lovers out there. Chef Daniel Orr has picked some fresh broccoli to make cold soup with tofu.
If you grow broccoli in your garden, you'll get one really nice big head of broccoli from each plant, but you cut that off and then it will send out some other little shoots of broccoli, and that's what I've got here. But you got to get rid of the caterpillars.
Oh, sure enough. Are the leaves something that you could, steam and serve with?
Yeah, if you're doing a stir fry, use them like you would use any greens. You can use them as you'd use beet greens or collards or any of those kind of things. Now I've got some water boiling. Now for this recipe, we want to cook the broccoli till it's tender. Put a decent amount of salt in there because that's going to allow the water temperature to actually increase over the boiling point, and it'll cook the vegetables even quicker. In the meantime, we're going to go back to our trusty blender. We're going to put everything except for the broccoli into the blender and get it ready to whirl. A half a jalapeno, 2 garlic cloves, 15 basil leaves, 2 tablespoons of ginger, and a half pound of silken tofu.
Mm. Something I'm noticing about your cooking, chef, green is one of the prominent colors.
When you're cooking broccoli or any of the green vegetables, you really want them to be green. A lot of people overcook vegetables and they kind of turn gray or khaki colored. You know, you're losing a lot of the minerals that way. I'm going to add 1 little ladle of this cooking liquid.
I was going to ask if we were going to use the dregs of the broccoli.
Yeah, you definitely can use that. And when you're cooking pasta, you don't throw away all the pasta water. You can incorporate a little bit of that into your sauce. I also like to blanch more than one thing in the same pot. You're building up vitamins into that water, and you're reusing those again and again. So you can also save that and almost have it as a vegetable stock after you've cooked a lot of different vegetables in it. And then the other thing you can do is let it cool down and then take it out and water your plants with it, if you don't have salt in it, of course.
You guys, you reuse everything in this house.
So then again, this is a soup you could have either hot or cold. When you pour it freshly out of that blender, it's kind of a little bit foamy and light, and I think it will just kind of dance on your tongue.
Boy, the soup is a hit. You know, it's funny. No one made mention of the tofu. We just sort of forgot about it.
And it really does have that creaminess. So if we didn't have the tofu in there, it wouldn't have been the same color. It wouldn't have the same mouthfeel. It just adds to the soup in its own little mellow way.
Chef Orr garnished this soup with nasturtiums to add a nice peppery kick.
Get additional ideas for how to incorporate edible flowers into your cooking from author and gardener Denise Schreiber. And there are plenty of other cold soup recipes on our website. Find it all and much, much more at eartheats.org. Coming up, obesity rates in the U.S. are going in the wrong direction. But according to a new study, that's not all that surprising.
We're not going to stem those statistics or change them overnight, since it's taken, you know, 5 decades for us to nearly triple that rate of obesity.
That's researcher Terry Spradlin. Earth Eats' Amanda Soliday speaks with him about the role schools can play in fighting childhood obesity. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. In 2010, folks from a coffee roastery in North Carolina, a cafe in Washington, D.C., and a coffee farm in El Salvador teamed up in a year-long effort to track their carbon use in coffee production. What they found surprised them and may change the way you approach your morning cup of joe. Earth Eats' Stephanie Hartono has more about sustainability and the specialty coffee industry.
Your morning cup of coffee is the end result of a journey of thousands of miles and the work of many hands. Farmers cultivate trees for years and painstakingly harvest only the ripest coffee cherries. From there, the fruit must be processed to remove the pulp and expose the bean underneath. And once processed, buyers from around the world will taste their way through the coffee of a region. Finally, when all the coffee has been graded, processed, selected, and bought, it goes to port, where it will be shipped to all corners of the planet. And then somewhere, a roaster will transform the green beans into coffee proper, package, label, and ship it off again, where the coffee will find a spot on a shelf in your favorite grocery store or cafe. Surprisingly, even though that pound of coffee sitting on the shelf has traveled thousands of miles and has been through several energy and resource-intensive processes, it still uses less than 20% of its entire carbon footprint.
Well, the shocking thing was, when we did this, the lion's share of the carbon footprint of the life cycle of coffee from bean to beverage came at the very last step.
Peter Giuliano is the co-owner of Counterculture Coffee in Durham, North Carolina. Counterculture sources its coffee by working directly with farmers rather than buying from a middleman. He says that these strong relationships are mutually beneficial because the farmer has a committed buyer and the roaster gets better quality coffee.
And another good part of it is that your customers feel like they're on a first-name basis with some of the farmers. So everybody feels like they have a relationship, and they do.
In 2010, Counterculture collaborated with one of its customers, Peregrine Espresso in Washington, D.C., and one of its suppliers, Finca Mauritania in Santa Ana, El Salvador, to complete a carbon life cycle analysis of coffee from farm to cup. The coffee traveled from Santa Ana, El Salvador to New Jersey for import, off to Durham, North Carolina for roasting, and then finally to D.C. for brewing. And what they learned surprised them.
More than 80% of the carbon that was used in the entire process was at the coffee shop. The energy used at the coffee shop to prepare and deliver that coffee to consumers. And transportation, the part that we thought and everybody thought would be a dominant part, was pretty much the smallest.
This is because, although the roaster uses a lot of heat, and the farmer uses a lot of water, and the shipper uses a lot of fuel, the equipment used at the cafe to heat water and to keep milk cool is far less energy efficient. This fact caused Giuliano to rethink how coffee is prepared.
It caused me to be a better consumer of equipment and actually dialoguing with the people that manufacture water heating devices, you know, to make them more efficient, insulate them better. But it also caused me to dialogue with the filter guys and say, wait a second, why are you making a filter that we have to rinse, that we use totally inefficient hot water to do that with?
For home coffee brewers, using a well-insulated water kettle and only heating the amount of water you'll need will immediately decrease the amount of carbon used. So next time you bring home a bag of coffee, consider that you, as the brewer, have the largest influence on its carbon footprint.
You know, by making people aware of this little factoid, it causes people to change their behavior, which, in this instance, will make a huge difference.
For Earth Eats, I'm Stephanie Hartono.
Children spend 7 to 8 hours at school during the week, and they eat one or two meals during that time. Because kids consume so many of their daily calories there, a new report says educators can play a substantial role in the overall childhood obesity rate. Earth Eats' Amanda Soliday sat down with education policy expert Terry Spradlin to learn more.
Terry Spradlin is the director for education policy at the Indiana University Center for Evaluation and Education Policy. He co-authored a recent report entitled Childhood Obesity and Nutrition Issues in the United States. It takes a look at the recent obesity statistics and delves into government programs and policies that aim to address the growing problem of childhood obesity. So your group originally published a similar report on childhood obesity in 2005. How have the obesity numbers for children and adolescents changed in the past 7 years?
Well, the long-term trend is this. Since 1960, our rate of adult obesity has nearly tripled from about 13% of the adult population in 1960 to about 35% today. So that's a concern too. And then when we look at our child population in America, we have about 23 million American children and teenagers that are either obese, overweight, or obese. So we're moving in the wrong direction.
And some of the background information that you presented in your article, you mentioned that obesity rates among all groups in society are increasing, regardless of age, sex, race, income, or education level. But it seems like nutrition and healthy eating are being pushed hard these days. So are we then to believe that all these tactics just aren't working?
You know, a lot of these initiatives are newer initiatives. You know, when I referred to our long-term trends with obesity rates, those were a 50-year period of time. And so we're not going to stem those statistics or change them overnight, since it's taken, you know, 5 decades for us to nearly triple that rate of obesity. So it's really reflective of our lifestyle and our choices that we make as citizens, as Americans. For example, the National School Lunch Program provides funding for students who are low income so that they receive a breakfast and lunch. The monies that are provided for that program, schools are spending about 72% of that on meat and cheese commodities, which are high in saturated fat. So the food items that schools have typically been purchasing because of their low expense and their calorie volume, those have been poor choices.
Well, we haven't talked about activity levels yet. That's certainly an important part of any dialogue about childhood obesity trends.
One interesting statistic in that regard, our children ages 8 to 18 are spending about 7.5 hours daily using media. And only 18% of students in grades 9 through 12 are fulfilling that 1 hour of daily physical activity. So our children, another societal change, they're becoming much more sedentary. One thing that we often overlook are the things that are less physical and visible, which are low self-esteem and depression. And that, too, contribute to a child's health and welfare. And students with low self-esteem often miss more days of school. They are less likely to be participant in extracurricular activities, so they're less engaged in the school day. And again, that, too, leads to lower academic achievement.
From what you're saying, it sounds as though schools play a pretty significant role in children's health and therefore can significantly affect the obesity rates.
We cannot diminish the role of public education or schools in general and the role that they play to provide health and nutrition education and physical activity opportunities. So we need to make sure kids are active during the school day, receiving, you know, a well-balanced nutritional meal.
Terry Spradlin is the Director for Education Policy at the Indiana University Center for Evaluation and Education Policy. Thanks for being here. It was a pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks to Earth Eat's newest member of the team, Amanda Soliday. Read more about this study on our website, eartheats.org. Back to the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr for a salad recipe that uses really only two main ingredients.
Roasted tomatoes?
Yep. We're going to use them in a salad today. So basically what we've done is we've taken some Roma tomatoes, you know, the kind of oblong sauce tomatoes they use in Italy, and we've cut them into quarters, and then we toss them with a little bit of olive oil, garlic, salt, and pepper. And then we put them under the broiler and let them get nice and caramelized. And you can see, you know, there's some nice dark caramelization on them. You can also throw in some fresh herbs or dried herbs, some summer savory, thyme, a little lavender, rosemary, and let them sit with the tomatoes for a while and then put them under the broiler, let them get nicely caramelized. The other part of this salad are some wonderful snow peas. These are some that my friend Kevin Baker brought me over from his garden, and these are his discards. They're a little bit big for him, but I think they've got great flavor. They almost look like lima beans are getting that big. It's kind of the end of the season for the snow peas, but I've blanched them in salted water, then shocked them in ice water like we do so often. We'll put that in a big bowl.
And we should say that we were snacking on these before we started this recipe, and they're delicious just chilled like this.
Yeah, they're perfect, and I'm not going to do a whole lot. I'm just going to basically have two ingredients in it. We've got the peas, and then we've got the about two-thirds the same amount of the tomatoes. And we're going to add a little bit of olive oil, a little chopped garlic, teaspoon of lemon zest, and then guess what? A whole handful of summer herbs. So basil, mint, cilantro, chervil, scallions, whatever you have. You're just going to rough cut it, again, because we want every bite to be a little different. And see, we're not making a traditional salad that has a lot of vinegar or acid in it, because we want these pea pods to stay looking nice and green. And if we added lemon juice or vinegar, by the time you got to the picnic, they'd look like someone's army fatigues. So we don't want that to happen. So, you know, this just is enrobed in the olive oil with that slight acidity from the roasted tomatoes. The only thing we need to add is a little salt and pepper to taste. We've got all those ingredients together, toss them around. Again, this is another great salad to throw in a Ziploc bag, put it in your cooler, and take it to a picnic.
Christmas colors in July. Find the recipe for this and other ideas for using fresh beets and leeks. As always, our bloggers are cooking up some tasty dishes at eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week on Earth Eats, we're taking it to the streets in Columbus, Ohio. Bethia Wolf gives us a tour of the city's many taco trucks. Come back for that. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.